I've made it clear that my administration's policy would be to support unions organizing and the right to collectively bargain. I'm keeping that promise. You should all remember, the National Labor Relations Act didn't just say that unions are allowed to exist. It said that we should encourage unions. It's not up to me to decide whether anyone should join a union. It's not up to an employer to decide that either. The choice to join a union is up to the workers, full stop.
You are right, President Biden. Now, after they join that union, who's going to enforce the laws?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
We'll talk about it.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am... From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., 98.7 in Santa Barbara, 93.7 in San Diego, 99.5 in Ridgecrest and China Lake. Also in California on KFOI in Red Bluff and Redding and Round Mountains, KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast, KYAQ, Cottage Grove's Queso, Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii. KAKU in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950. KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe for you every day on the internets on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, Workforce Rising, No Lies Radio, Verdant Square Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me. From bradblog.com. Your mileage may vary. Welcome to another thrilling edition of the Bradcast. Okay, there was some fairly big news over the weekend, and no, it does not involve Donald Trump and CPAC and whatever nonsense went on there, because I don't actually care about it. But the big news over the weekend comes out of the UN. It regards oceans that I suspect, pardon the pun, is likely to be drowned out by other pressing and or maybe sexier matters. So if the radio gods are with me today, Desi Doyen, we will hopefully have a few minutes later in the program to discuss what happened, to discuss the weekend drama regarding the UN Convention of the Law of the Sea.
Yeah, kind of a big deal.
Kind of a big deal, and I'm sure it's not going to get the coverage that it actually deserves.
It already has not gotten the coverage it deserves.
Well, we will try to do something about that a little bit later, if time allows. But first, as I've got an excellent guest standing by, waiting to join us, let me get straight into today's main story on the Bradcast. Late last summer, according to polling by Gallup at the time, 71% of Americans approved of labor unions. That number was up 3% from the year prior and a full 7% from the year before that, prior to the pandemic. The approval rating for labor unions and their power of collective bargaining for workers last year was the highest that Gallup had measured since 1965 in its survey, that they actually began back in 1936, when Americans' approval for unions was just 1 point higher than it was last year. The latest approval figures come amid a burst of 2022 union victories, or at least apparent ones, across the country, with high-profile successes at major corporations like Amazon and Starbucks. The National Labor Relations Board, or NLRB, the federal agency that is supposed to serve as a public watchdog for union members and union rights, they reported a 57% increase in union election petitions filed during the first 6 months of the year 2021. Support for labor unions was highest in the 1950s, when 3 in 4 Americans said they approved of unions, with its survey number topping out at 75% support. Back in the 50s, support only dipped below the 50% mark one time. That was in 2009, but it has improved in each of the 13 years since, and now sits at a level last seen nearly 60 years ago. That, of course, should be good news for workers. It certainly seems like it. But as you might expect, companies, particularly large companies, are fighting those helping to organize and negotiate for new unions and new union members and new union contracts. In fact, despite high-profile victories for new union organizing campaigns over the last year or so, companies are not only pushing back, they are actually out and out violating federal labor law in order to do it, including by penalizing and firing workers alleged to be behind the union organizing campaigns. As The Guardian reported late last month, U.S. corporations have mounted a fierce counterattack against the union drives at Starbucks, Amazon, other companies, and in response, federal officials are working overtime to crack down on those corporations' illegal anti-union tactics, maneuvers that labor leaders fear could significantly drain the momentum behind today's surge of unionization. The NLRB, the federal agency that polices labor management relations, has accused Starbucks and Amazon of a slew of illegal anti-union practices, among them firing many workers in retaliation for backing a union. Nonetheless, many workplace experts question whether the NLRB's efforts, no matter how vigorous, can assure that workers have a fair shot at unionizing. Quote, "We're seeing the same situation over and over. Workers going up against billionaires and billion-dollar companies with an endless amount of resources, while our labor laws are far too weak," said Michelle Eisen, a barista in Buffalo, New York, who helped lead the early unionization efforts of Starbucks in that city. "We're all fighting for the same thing against different companies," she noted. "The labor board is doing its job with the limited resources it has," she added, "but Starbucks continues to break the law flagrantly." The union asserts that Starbucks has engaged in illegal retaliation by firing some 150 pro-union baristas and closing down a dozen recently unionized stores. Indeed, just last week, a federal administrative law judge found Starbucks committed, quote, "egregious and widespread violations of federal labor law while trying to halt union campaigns," according to Washington Post. The judge has now ordered the coffee giant to reopen closed stores and reimburse back pay and damages to employees who launched a nationwide organizing drive at the company. Starbucks showed, quote, "a general disregard for the employees' fundamental rights," said Judge Michael Rosas in his 220-page order released last Wednesday. "In resolving an extensive case that combined 33 unfair labor practice charges in 21 stores in the Buffalo area, Rosas held that the company retaliated against employees affiliated with Starbucks Workers United as they began a union drive back in 2021. As the Post reported, Judge Rosa's order requires Starbucks to halt a sweeping list of behaviors that include retaliating against employees for unionizing, promising improved pay and benefits if workers renounced the union, surveilling union-supporting employees while on site, refusing to hire prospective employees who back the union, and relocating union organizers to new stores to halt the group's activities. Starbucks, the judge said, must reopen stores it closed as union momentum swelled among workers, rescind dozens of disciplinary actions taken against Buffalo area employees, pay, quote, "reasonable consequential damages, and offer to reinstate terminated workers to their jobs." Rosa's order also calls for Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz and Denise Nelson, the company's senior vice president of U.S. operations, to read a 14-page notice that explains workers' rights and how the company violated the law. That same notice must then be posted in each of the company's stores, according to the judge, and shared digitally with all employees. He also ordered Starbucks to begin negotiating a collective bargaining agreement with Buffalo area workers. Correct. They have yet to even begin negotiating. When workers launched their organizing campaign in the summer of 2021, said Gary Bonadonna Jr., manager of the Workers United Rochester Regional Joint Board, in a statement, we never could have imagined the lengths that Starbucks would go to stop employees from exercising their legal right to organize. This ruling, he said, proves what we have been saying all along. Starbucks is the poster child of union busting in the U.S. Starbucks spokesperson Andrew Trull said the company believes the judge's ruling and order are, quote, inappropriate given the record in this matter. Starbucks is considering, quote, all options to obtain further legal review. Of course, the encouraging judgment in New York comes a year after the organizing campaigns began, only regarding what happened to the stores in Buffalo, this ruling, and it only deals with Starbucks specifically. There's a lot of other companies who are doing the same thing. Companies, including Starbucks, have determined that the penalty for retaliation against these workers is minimal and much more appealing than allowing workers to unionize. That, according to Lynn Fox, president of Workers United, the union that workers at more than 280 Starbucks have voted to join. Quote, violating workers' rights has simply become part of the cost of doing business. Newly unionized workers are also frustrated and angry that efforts to reach a first contract are taking so long, with some unions asserting that companies are deliberately and illegally dragging out negotiations, an assertion that the companies deny. Workers won breakthrough union victories at Starbucks in December of 21, and the next year saw several other organizing victories. REI workers had a successful union vote in March of 22, Amazon in April, Apple in June, Trader Joe's in July, and Chipotle in August. But none of those companies have yet reached a first contract. The extraordinary recent wave of unionizations that corporate America has faced over the past year has been met with what union supporters say is an equally extraordinary wave of union busting that has slowed and even stopped some of these unionization efforts. Shortly after workers at Chipotle in Augusta, Maine, for example, petitioned for a unionization vote, in the hope of becoming the first Chipotle in the U.S. to unionize, well, the company shut down that store. They shut the entire store down rather than allow them to vote to join a union. The NLRB has accused Chipotle of illegal retaliation and sought to order the fast food chain to reopen that store. Chipotle says the closing was for a legitimate business reason, had nothing to do. Nothing to do with the unionization vote. The NLRB has accused Apple of illegally spying on and threatening workers. The company's anti-union efforts helped pressure Apple store workers in Atlanta to withdraw their request to hold a union election. Although workers at Apple stores in Towson, Maryland, and Oklahoma City have voted to unionize. Trader Joe's closed its one wine shop in New York City just days before that shop's workers were to announce plans to seek a union election. The workers have accused the company of shutting the store to quash the union drive and retaliate against the workers. Trader Joe's, of course, denies the allegation. last month, just one day after employees at a Tesla plant in Buffalo announced their plans to unionize, well, Tesla fired dozens of workers there. Union supporters complained to the NLRB that Tesla dismissed 37 workers, quote, in retaliation for union activity and to discourage union activity. Tesla said the terminations had nothing to do with the union drive. They were simply part of its regular performance evaluation process. In late 2021, an Amazon facility in Bessemer, Alabama, had been ordered by the NLRB to hold a second election for a union organizing campaign there after the company had blatantly violated instructions from the federal board on how the election should be held. When the second vote was finally held, many of the original organizers of the campaign had sadly moved on, and that vote ultimately failed as well. After the NLRB found that Amazon had committed multiple violations during the first election, we were joined on this show at the time by a labor historian who explained that all of these tactics are familiar and repeatedly carried out by major corporations because the penalties for doing so are apparently less than the cost to the companies, as they see it anyway, of allowing union organization. At the time on this program, we discussed the need to improve labor law, even as many labor organizers were hopeful that President Biden's NLRB would be much more sympathetic to workers' rights than they were under the anti-union board during the administration of Donald J. Trump. Well, joining us again today to help make sense of where things are today, where we have gotten a year or two later, down the road for labor, after 2 years of a seemingly much friendlier federal Department of Labor and National Labor Relations Board than we saw during Trump's presidency, certainly, even as union organizing campaigns and contract negotiations are still being quashed by major companies all across the country who apparently find the current penalties for violating labor law to be little more than the cost of doing business. Joining us now is Nelson Lichtenstein, labor historian and distinguished professor in the Department of History at the University of California, Santa Barbara, where he directs the Center for the Study of Work, Labor, and Democracy. He is the author of at least 16 books on related matters, including recent works such as Achieving Workers' Rights in the Global Economy. He's also an inducted member of the Society of American Historians and winner of the 2012 Sidney Hillman Foundation's Sol Steaton Award for Lifetime Achievement in Labor History. Professor Lichtenstein, we are honored to have you back again on the broadcast today, sir.
Glad to be here.
Now, not to pick on Starbucks specifically, Nelson, but they do seem to be making a name for themselves in the union-busting field of late. According to The Guardian, the NLRB has brought 75 complaints against Starbucks that accuse it of more than 1,000 illegal actions. Federal judges have ordered Starbucks to reinstate numerous pro-union baristas who they say were fired illegally. The labor board has accused Starbucks of refusing to bargain with workers at 21 stores in Oregon and Washington. And according to the union, Starbucks is deliberately dragging out contract negotiations to dishearten union supporters. Does any of this, even the seemingly huge number of complaints and accusations of violations of labor law, does any of this surprise you at this point, or is this what you might have expected or par for the course historically during these periods of apparent expansion of U.S. labor movements?
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's par for the course, and unfortunately, it shouldn't be surprising. Walmart did this 15 years ago, and it was a big union push at Walmart. Companies that find themselves subject to these kind of campaigns. Yes, this is par for the course, and it's sort of standard operating procedure that we've had now almost 50 years of specialized anti-labor law firms and handbooks. The language of the little handouts they do, the language of the captive audience meetings, the strategy remains identical, and it works. I mean, why change it? It works. And the article you were by Stephen Greenhouse you were reading The Guardian indicated that despite the public relations hit that a company like Starbucks, you know, has had in the past a kind of warm and fuzzy a sense of you know, relationship with customers. It's taking a big public relations hit, mm-hmm. and these other kinds of companies are too. But the managers, you know, they've had their meetings. They run the numbers. They've decided that we'll take a small, you know, reduction in their growth or their customers, like boycott, and it's worth it. I would say that the tremendous pushback that you outlined is really a tribute to the importance of unionism. Because, I mean, the official line of these companies is, oh, you know, unions have to change anything. You know, why do this? Well, they're moving heaven and earth to stop the union.
Right.
So that's a tribute to the importance of unionism that they're going to do all that. I mean, it isn't. They don't just send in some lawyer to the Starbucks in Buffalo or the store. They send in their vice president, you know, and things of that sort. It's very important to them. So, but unfortunately, it is working out. Now, the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, is today the most pro-labor, the most aggressively pro-labor. It's very good. It's staffed with good people. It doesn't have enough money, but it is staffed with good people. And as you indicated, they're putting together really real indictments of these companies stalling and illegally firing people. The problem is that the NLRB really doesn't have any disciplinary tools at its command. It just the penalties for breaking the law at the NLRB stage are really minuscule, and the companies know they will appeal all these things to the courts. And that has two virtues. The first virtue is delay. That's the main virtue. They know that just wait. I mean, the turnover rate is 100% at these companies. So just wait a year and everyone's gone, or half people are gone. The second thing is the courts aren't very good. Half of them are staff of the Republicans. And the Democrats, who were the judges appointed by Democrats, they haven't, you know, their definition of liberalism for many years hasn't included sort of, you know, backing the trade union movement. They're kind of unreliable. Mm. So the courts are you know, the companies just go to the courts, and they again, delay is their main ally.
I'm struck by, you say that these are specialty lawyers. So these are not just the company lawyers that are already on staff. There is actually an industry, is there, for anti-union lawyering around this country?
Yes, there is. And the law firms, Jackson Lewis, and one in Chicago, and there are about 10 or 15 of them. They're specialized. They do many things, actually. They have various aspects of their sort of work, but one big part of it is fighting unions, and there's a handbook. It's sort of routine. They know how to do it. Because I've seen the kind of arguments made that anti-union arguments at Starbucks. They're identical to what they made at Walmart a decade ago, or some other place 20 years ago. The union can't get you anything. The dues are expensive. This is futile to do it. You create the distrust in the workplace, etc. I mean, it's the same line. And so these guys, they get paid. I mean, here's the other tribute to the importance of unionism. These guys are being paid $500 an hour. Enormous amounts of money. It's just ridiculous. Some guy in a suit walks in there, he's going to earn like $1,000 in a day. And meanwhile, he's trying to convince some barista who's earning, you know, $14 an hour not to join the union. I mean, what that indicates is it's important. Important from their point of view to keep the union out. And actually, I'll tell you something. They're right. They're right. It's important. And here's the reason. Because what unions do is they don't just raise wages, although that's important, and they do that. What they do is they are a permanent institution which will always be there and will always be sort of checking and second guessing what management wants to do, whether it's putting in shorter hours, whether it's rearranging schedules, et cetera. So, see, one of the things is the consciousness of people is episodic. Right now, as you pointed out, we're in a period of extremely pro-labor sentiment, and that's a great thing. Mm-hmm. And all these young people, whether it's the University of California where I teach, we had this tremendous strike, mm-hmm. and it was a success, or whether it's in baristas, in Starbucks, there's a tremendous mobilization taking place. This is terrific. What will happen is, and the company's response is, many times, okay, we'll give you another dollar an hour. Okay, we'll make some adjustments. Mm-hmm. But their strategy is, and they know, whether they articulate it or not, consciousness can fade. A year from now, 2 years from now, maybe it'll be a recession, mm-hmm. Et cetera, consciousness can fade. And then, we can just do what we want. We aren't worried. But you see, we have a union, and it's an institution. It's a legally recognized institution. It means that 3 years from now, when every barista has long since left, or at the University of California, when every TA or has gone on,
right.
The union still exists. It now has new people.
Right.
It's a permanent institution. And therefore, it will always be there to check and to mobilize its own members and to confront management.
Mm-hmm.
And that is expensive. I mean, in the long run, that is expensive. And that's why these companies, in one sense, they are correct to pay $1 million, $5 million to some anti-union law firm to stop the union, because the union is a mechanism for redistributing both power and income,
it was interesting that all of these companies, you talk about, trying to prevent the unionization in the first place and all the tactics that they go through. Well, in the Amazon warehouse at JFK 8 warehouse on Staten Island, Amazon labor union, 8,300 employees, a huge victory. Well, that was last April, almost a year ago, and they have filed a challenge to that victory. And in the meantime, the NLRB has ruled against them. As you said, it's been a very good NLRB in most parts. Now Amazon's appealing. But in the meantime, apparently, a year later, after the unionization votes, there have been no contract talks. So even once they get unions, then they start delaying on even beginning contract negotiations.
Right, because as I say, a contract is this legal instrument which says that people are in the union and that they have a grievance procedure and they have this and that, and that new people who come in can be part of the union. The union is like self-perpetuating; it's like immortal. It continues on into the. I mean, the UAW has been in existence for 80 years. Long since after the original red hot radicals formed it. In the 1930s. And that's what these companies don't want. So yes, it's at Amazon, the Amazon thing, it's the standard playbook. That's they won the election, but a contract, we'll just slow walk this forever.
And are there any requirements, Nelson, that after a successful union vote, for when companies must finally begin contract negotiations with workers, or is it all just?
No, they begin them, but you can sit around a table forever, and that's what they do. And they sit around a table forever, and the answer is no. But there is no requirement. Now, some of the laws that have been proposed, the PRO Act, Protect the Right to Organize, and other laws, have always said, and they do this in other countries. I think in Canada this is done. That if you reach an impasse in collective bargaining, the company delays, then an arbitrator can come in and impose the contract. That happens in some public employment in the United States, and it happens in Canada and a few other places. But a law of that sort has been filibustered and blocked, for decades and decades. So, what you need to do is change the incentive structure for these companies. And I have a couple. And one idea, which it'll take a while. But right now, one of the things that is most exciting in the Biden administration is the revitalization of antitrust law. Mm-hmm. Now, when I say antitrust, you think about breaking up the company. But that's not what I'm talking about, and that's not really even what the people in the Biden administration, who are very pro-union. I mean, people in the Federal Trade Commission and in the Department of Justice's antitrust division, they are pro-union. They aren't. some old, you know, white shoe lawyer. And what they want to do, and I mean, it'll take a while, is you say, well, antitrust was originally put together in the 1890s to democratize these giant, you know, centers of economic power. Mm-hmm. And democratization doesn't just mean breaking them up into small units. It can also mean ensuring that there's other voices, like that of the consumer and of and the workers. And so I think the way to fight, certainly it's true at Silicon Valley, and is to say, look, unless you do agree to the recognize the union, you know, you're going to face your entire business model is going to face, you know, problems, i.e. you can't buy other companies, you know, you may be broken up, etc. And I think we need that kind of hammer, you know, against these companies if they fail to do what the law is. I mean, Biden is right that the labor law does not permit a formation of unions; it encourages it.
Mm-hmm.
In the 30s, it was designed to democratize the world of work, the world of industry, and this was thought to be as important as the democratization of the ballot box. It's not just permissive; it encourages. It's a good thing to have a union. That was the idea in the 30s and today as well.
And so, what you're suggesting is you mentioned the PRO Act, the Protect the Right to Organize Act. It was passed in the, I believe it passed in the Senate last session. It passed in the House. Well, that's right. And it couldn't overcome a filibuster in the U.S. Senate. Right. Every single Republican was against it. So that might have made increase the penalties for all of this, required arbitrators to come in when they couldn't. When the companies just refused to negotiate a contract. So without that, though, you're saying there are laws on the book, the antitrust laws that could be used. Is there any sign? Are you seeing the Obama administration Biden administration using those tools against these companies?
Yes, there's the beginning of that. Microsoft was on the verge of acquiring Activision gaming for, you know, many billions of dollars. And there was a kind of discussion, it hasn't really finished yet, a discourse about, okay, we'll allow you to acquire this new company if you issue a statement, and they did, which says we really aren't, you know, we'll be genuinely neutral when it comes to unionization. And Microsoft actually did do that. And in the past, there have been other occasions when that was the case, when companies, AMP, when it was a big, big chain, agreed to recognize the union in the retail clerks in those days, in return for not being broken up. This was in the late 30s and 40s.
Uh-huh.
Let me say that's PRO Act. I hope the PRO Act passed. It will be a good thing. It would not solve the problem, because as long as you can hire $500 an hour lawyers, you know, mm-hmm. they're going to figure out some way to get around it. What I'm talking about is changing, making it a good business decision to have a union, because the alternative is your whole business model is thwarted. And here you're talking about stockholders, you know, taking a hit, and you're talking about all sorts of stuff. And I think we have to change the mentality of management, even if it requires a 2x4 to do it.
Well, you have to change, frankly, the price that they are going to pay, because right now they are just blatantly, I mentioned, you know, more than 1,000 illegal actions regarding Starbucks in, you know, just the last few months that was found by the NLRB. Obviously, they are not afraid of the law when it comes to this. So
right,
you do
right.
have to improve.
Bernie is bringing Howard Schultz on the carpet before his committee, and I hope he really works him over. Schultz's reputation is going to be in the doghouse. But that alone will not do it. And the other legal strategy here is racketeering law.
Mm.
When you think about racketeering, you usually think, oh, that's applied to some union or something. Well, it has been, and maybe. But actually, when management is involved with a conspiracy to break the law, which is what we're having, what we have here, it's a conspiracy. They have meetings. They discuss how we're going to break the law. That's a racketeering.
Mm.
And I think that you could begin to use other kinds of legal penalties, legal strategies and penalties against management, not just the NLRB, which, again, they know how to fight the NLRB, unfortunately, even when it's run by liberals. So, I think you need a few of these executive spend some time in prison. That has happened in the past, and it could happen in the future.
You mentioned Senator Bernie Sanders. He's chair of the Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions. He said on Wednesday last week that he was going to force a vote to subpoena Howard Schultz of Starbucks to come in and answer some of these questions. But, you know, I mentioned during my intro, Professor Lichtenstein, that support for unions is now at a 60-year high and even getting close to an all-time high now in the U.S., even as labor union membership in recent decades has declined. As an historian, what do you attribute this surge now that we're seeing in support for in recent years for unions? Because it doesn't yet seem that that support is actually making its way into Democratic Party politics. And by and large, despite the fact that now 71% of the public support it, why aren't we hearing from Democratic candidates for office talking about the importance of passing the PRO Act, whether they can get it over a filibuster or not?
No, that's a very good point. What I'm saying is that sentiment alone, consciousness alone, is not enough. You need institutions. I mean, Martin Luther King didn't just want, you know, to change the hearts of his opponents of his what. He wanted a law. And
right.
That would be on the books, it would be enforced for decade after decade. And that changes the political calculus. So it's a great thing that 71 or 5% of Americans think unions are a good thing. But again, that consciousness is that sentiment is episodic. It could next time you have a recession. By the way, support for unions tends to decline during recessions. For a variety of reasons. I mean, they sort of a sense there's certain blame. Who's going to be blamed for it? I mean, obviously today, one reason that the support for unions is high, it's not just these large questions of inequality, which we've had for decades. It's that I think the pandemic had the effect of discrediting management in many, many ways. Workers really felt that a kind of they were putting out, you know, they were essential. They were being praised by everyone, the nurses and grocery clerks. And here, the management was not reciprocating. And I think that sense of betrayal on the part of many workers, whether they weren't thinking about unionism so much, but it meant that they couldn't look to managers and to the company to safeguard them. I mean, they were laid off, and they were given a raise, and then the raise was taken away from them, and they were told to work in unhealthy conditions. I think there was a sense of betrayal. It was the same sort of thing in the early 30s when the Depression hit, and there was a sort of a sense that the companies which had been, you know, the stalwart, you know, bulwarks of prosperity, Henry Ford, etc., that they had failed. They failed, and they betrayed their workers. And then people look for something else. And I think that's part of it.
Got it. Let me, Nelson, I've got very quickly two questions I want to hit before I get out. I'm already running late. But this is from a listener. This came in via email over the weekend, someone who didn't even know I was going to be talking to you about any of this. And it's a question that I was not able to answer. So maybe you can. The listener wrote to ask, can you tell me who regulates public sector teacher union elections? He said, I am a member of the United Teachers of Los Angeles. We recently had our first ever totally online election of our officers using, and he points to a website named ivsballot.com. And it sounds like he had concerns about that online election. But I don't know who would be the regulatory authority here. Are public unions overseen by NLRB?
No, it is not, because school teachers are public employees, so they are not regulated by the NLRB. Although the NLRB itself has often changed, you know, would make it more easy to vote, so they sometimes online. No, public employees, school teachers, are the law that governs that in LA would be the California Public Employment Law, and that provides for various kinds of elections. And again, sometimes elections online is more convenient and better than, you know, ballot boxes and things of that sort. So it's public employees, whether it's the Department of Motor Vehicles or the police or the firemen or the school teachers are governed by the state. And so some states have very good labor laws and sort of encourage you know, trade unionism, and other states, absolutely not. A state of, you know, like Alabama or Texas, it's illegal to form a union of a public employee.
Right.
It's illegal. And so they, you know, they don't have it. So it varies state to state.
All right. So I'll point this listener to the California Public Employment Law for information on that. Finally, what's that?
Yeah. Go ahead, yeah.
Yeah, well, finally, you know, so it's sort of an odd mix here that we're talking about. Even last time we had you on a year or two ago, it's kind of an odd mix of both good news and bad news, it seems, for labor of late. Are you overall, from a historian's viewpoint here, are you optimistic or are you pessimistic at this point about the direction that things are going in 2023 for workers in the U.S.?
No, I'm optimistic, and I'll tell you why, because I think there's a whole new layer of activists and militants and engaged people, and we see that not just at Starbucks, we see all that in higher education, and they're really in motion. The working class does not advance in uniform fashion. There's always one layer that's ahead. You know, in the 60s, it was African Americans. In the 1930s, it was immigrants. Mm-hmm. Today, it's young, relatively well-educated people who are in motion. I mean, and that's terrific, and so that makes me very optimistic.
Well, we will end it on that optimistic note. There are few and far between these days sometimes on this program. Professor Dr. Nelson Lichtenstein of the University of California, Santa Barbara, distinguished professor in the Department of History, labor historian. Always great to have you on, Nelson. Thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for your insight. And I hope you won't mind if we bother you again in the not too distant future, sir.
Well, you're welcome indeed.
Thank you. Okay, excellent. Well, let's take a quick break. We'll come back with, I don't know, we may even have some time for some calls if you want to give us a shout. 818-985-5735. 818-985-KPFK is our phone number. But I do want to get to Desi Doyen on the oceans. So let's take a quick break. Let Desi get her swimsuit on, whatever is going to be required here. We'll talk to her straight ahead on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At the broadcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently, without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
I'll keep working my way.
Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com, working our way to Desi Doyen for this good news that is otherwise getting sunk by, if you will, by other by other news. For the first time,
or swamped or inundated.
Swamped, there you go. Soaked.
Choose your metaphor.
For the first time, according to AP, in a dramatic overtime session over the weekend, UN members agreed on a unified treaty to protect biodiversity in the high seas, representing what they characterize as a turning point for vast stretches of the planet, where conservation has previously been hampered by a confusing patchwork of laws, or sometimes no laws at all. The UN Convention on the Law of the Sea came into force initially in 1994. Before marine biodiversity was a well-established concept, the treaty agreement's new framework concluded over the weekend. It concluded 2 weeks of talks in New York on Saturday after they were scheduled to end on Friday, but they reached they worked all through the night and into late Saturday before they finally got their
agreement. It's always like that. It always takes to the last minute.
And this updated framework to protect marine life in the regions outside of national boundary waters, known as the high seas, had been in discussion for more than 20 years, but previous efforts to reach an agreement had repeatedly stalled. The Unified Agreement treaty, reached late Saturday during overtime, will apply to nearly half the planet's surface. So, yeah, seems like kind of a big and, frankly, long overdue deal, Desi Doyen.
It is. It is a very, very big deal. As you mentioned, it's like nearly 200 countries. This treaty covers half of the planet's surface, or nearly half, the part that's covered with water. As you mentioned, conservation has been hampered by this patchwork of regulations because only about 1% of the ocean is under some kind of protective regime or mechanism. So this is a new
1%.
Just 1%.
Wow.
So that's not much. This is a new and very legally binding treaty. It will create a new board to manage conservation of ocean life with a framework to identify and establish new marine protected areas on the high seas. Again, those are the places that are outside areas that are in the territorial waters of countries, which only extend out to about 200 miles off the coast. So there's a vast area that is not covered. So it also sets up ground rules for operating in those marine protected areas for countries that wish to go ahead and fish there. There will be rules that will be applied to that, and they'll be across the board the same for everybody. And it's really seen as being essential, this treaty, to following through on an agreement that was signed by world governments back in December in Montreal, a very historic conference, to conserve 30% of the world's land and ocean by 2030. So the text outlines these mechanisms to conserve and set up sustainable use rules for these marine biodiversity areas. And it stitches together various current management regimes. There are lots of different groups that have different sectors of authority, like over international fishing or international mining, but they're so far have been unable to reach agreements that are actually effective. And sometimes they can't even reach any agreement at all. They're just, mired by infighting. So there are other issues that they will also cover, like pollution and industrial overfishing that has been depleting marine species and driving many of them to extinction.
So this is a sort of an overreaching. Is it fair to say this is sort of the Paris Agreement of the oceans?
That would be very fair to say that. And it, it will require environmental impact assessments and apply. Everybody will be applied and have the same rules applied to them for projects that they want to undertake, especially really harmful activities like deep sea bed mining, which without any kind of regulation or oversight in place, basically a company can just go out there and mine at will with nobody watching to make sure that they're not destroying something important that we need, or geoengineering experiments. Those are also being considered right now to combat climate change, like ocean acidification. So we really desperately need to have an international regime in place to prevent rogue countries from taking experiments like geoengineering in the ocean that could affect everybody.
Let me ask you about that. Georgetown marine biologist Rebecca Helms notes, quote, "We only have two major global commons, the atmosphere and the oceans," adding that while the oceans may draw less attention, quote, "protecting this half of Earth's surface is absolutely critical to the health of our planet, and they do work together." That would be both the oceans and the atmosphere. I recall when we started our Green News Report, now just over 14 years ago, we're in our 15th year of that. It's heard twice weekly on the broadcast. One of the points that you often made in response at the time to climate change deniers who had claimed, oh, the Earth is not warming at all. Remember that? not warming at all. Where would you get such an idea? And besides, even if it was, carbon dioxide is nothing that can actually harm anything. And you always responded, well, if it's not happening at all, how do you explain the acidification of the oceans? And those deniers would never have any real answer to that, would they?
No.
So they do work together, right?
Oh, absolutely. So the oceans and the atmosphere, it's an interactive system. It's a global interactive system. The oceans absorb 90% of the heat that humans are trapping with our release of greenhouse gases. The ocean also absorbs carbon dioxide, like a can of Coca-Cola or a can of soda. And so that is what ocean acidification is. It is the absorption of all of these excess amounts that of carbon dioxide that humans are releasing into the atmosphere. And ocean acidification is a very serious, very dangerous problem that could actually literally kill life in the oceans, because if you have an if the ocean becomes too acidic, then shell forming organisms, mm-hmm. like mollusks and clams, for example, shell forming organisms cannot form their shells. They don't have the correct chemistry in the water of the ocean to do so, and that has very grave implications for the food supply in the ocean. So yeah, ocean acidification is definitely a consequence of man-made global warming and our release of carbon dioxide.
And is that what's responsible for the death of the coral reefs around the
country? That is. That is. Well, it's two. It's a multiple problem for the coral reefs. Part of it is ocean acidification, which dissolves the reefs and dissolves the little organisms that live in them. But it's also ocean heating. Mm-hmm. Again, the oceans absorb a lot of the heat that humanity is trapping in the atmosphere. That's part of that interactive system. And the ocean heat is what's killing the ocean, the reefs, the coral reefs. Now, there's a really crucial part of this that the treaty includes. It includes a commitment by developed countries to provide an additional 50% of their annual financial contributions under the agreement to help developing countries. Mm-hmm. That was a big sticking point, as it was with the Paris Agreement,
right.
How much developed countries who have made all this money and gotten rich by exploiting and extracting the ocean's resources for the developed countries, to help developing countries who do not have the capacity necessarily to protect their waters by themselves.
And of course, they are the ones most at threat to all of this and, you know, are likely to be overtaken by many of the oceans that we're talking about regulating.
Yeah, here. And there's one last component that's very important. The nations must now internally ratify the treaty for it to come into effect. So, as you mentioned, the UN Convention Law of the Sea came into force in 1994. And although the United States recognizes the law of the sea as a codification of the customary international laws, the U.S. has never ratified it.
Yes.
Republicans halted the ratification. Mm-hmm. They've never allowed it to go through. Even as most recently as the Obama administration in 2012, Republicans blocked it. But, you know, we still abide by it, but we aren't a party to it. So that is going to be a thing that's going to also be a major controversy.
It has to be formally approved by the U.S. Senate.
By two-thirds of the U.S. Senate.
Two-thirds of the
U.S. And the Senate
Senate
Republicans, you know, they are afraid that it's going to undermine U.S. sovereignty, but really what they're talking about is the ability of private industry to basically extract whatever they want.
Yep, that sounds like them.
That's where we are.
Thank you very much, Desi Doyen. Let me take one more quick break here. We'll come back. Like I said, if you do want to get in, call 818-985-5735. We'll see what we have time for after we come back from this break. I'm Brad Friedman. You are listening to The Bradcast. Hey, this is Brad. Please consider supporting whichever progressive media outlet is serving you. Most, just like us, do not receive corporate or political support. We all need your support to counter the powerful corporate media echo chamber. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Oh, that's an oldie but goodie. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from Bradblog.com with your favorite hits from the 80s. That's the Tom Tom Club. I've got, we'll see if we have time for some calls, 818-985-KPFK. This is the time of year, the one time of year when I find something nice to say about the horrific Republican Congress that we all suffered under during the reign of George W. Bush, when I recognize nearly the only thing that I can recall that I'm willing to say nice about that period, other than that particular Congress's extension for 25 years of the Voting Rights Act, which obviously they did not mean, because the very same Republicans have been supporting the Voting Rights Act being gutted ever since by the U.S. Supreme Court. But the one thing that they have not yet screwed up is their extension of daylight savings time to make the season of later sunlight go longer by starting in March, going all the way through to November. Daylight saving time begins, frankly, not a moment too soon, this coming weekend, March 12, I think it is. But now there's also this. A bipartisan group of 12 U.S. senators on Thursday reintroduced legislation that would make daylight saving time permanent. nearly a year after the Senate voted unanimously to end clock switching. The Senate, back in March of 22, voted to end the twice annual changing of clocks in the U.S. in a move promoted by supporters advocating brighter afternoons and more economic activity. But the bill failed to get a vote last year in the U.S. House because lawmakers could not agree on whether to keep standard time or permanent daylight saving time. That, according to New Jersey Democratic Rep. Frank Pallone. Florida Republican Senators Rick Scott and Marco Rubio were joined by 10 other senators, including Democrats Ed Markey and Ron Wyden, in reintroducing the Sunshine Protection Act. Stupid name, but a great idea. While Florida Congressman Vern Buchanan introduced companion legislation in the House, Senator Scott said, regarding the only thing that I may ever agree with Rick Scott about. He said, quote, changing the clock twice a year is outdated and unnecessary. It's time for Congress to act and pass the good bill today. Correct. Correct, Senator Scott. You never hear me say that. Correct, Senator Scott. But only if it will make daylight saving time permanent. If they make standard time permanent, I withdraw my endorsement, Desi Doyen. That's it.
I know you do. Science is not on your side for that, but we can talk about that another day.
Oh, yes, it is. And we will talk about it another day. According to supporters, the change would help enable children to play outdoors later and reduce seasonal depression. I know it does for me. I don't know why Desi Doyen hates children so much that they don't want to let them play outdoors. Critics say that the change would force millions of school children, however, to go to classes in the dark for part of the year. Well, maybe some of the kids should have thought about that before they became born. I'm just saying. Sleep experts, there's such a thing as sleep experts. They say that daylight savings time makes it harder to be alert in the morning. Then again, sleep experts are welcome to sleep in an extra hour if they wish. Since 2015, about 30 states have introduced legislation to end the twice-yearly changing of clocks, some states proposing to do it only if neighboring states do the same. See, even a majority of states back the idea. Like George W. Bush, I am a uniter, not a divider. Supporters say the changes could prevent a slight uptick in car crashes that typically occurs around time changes. See, so I'm saving people's lives here. They argue the measure could help businesses like golf courses that could draw more use in the evening daylight. So I just want to help Donald Trump stay in business. Is that so bad? You're welcome. Don't worry. The bill will allow Arizona and Hawaii, which do not observe daylight savings time. They don't deserve it either, to remain on standard time. But there you go. Disagree? Feel free to let me know. I am bradcast@bradblog.com via email. You can tweet me or text me or whatever on the Facebooks, the Twitters, and the Mastodons at the Brad Blog. We got to get out. My thanks to our board operator, Yout Rosco, my producer, Desi Doyen, and my guest today, Professor Nelson Lichtenstein of University of California, Santa Barbara. That's it, I believe. If you missed any portion of today's program, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. No paywall, thanks to supporters who help the broadcast stay on your public airwaves. That's it. We'll see you at all of the above. Hopefully, we'll see you again tomorrow. Until then, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.